Several weeks ago, when I was at the doctor's office and they were talking about putting in my defibrillator, and they said I couldn't play golf for 8 weeks, I said, spring has just started. She said, oh, no. So the groundhog didn't see a shadow. And so she told me how far away spring was. And so today, as we come here this March Sunday, I think about all of those indications that was mentioned in our children's sermon about spring beginning. And sneezing several times this week has affirmed to me that spring must be in the air. And so it's either time to start spring cleaning or to enjoy March Madness. I won't ask you which one is your preference. But in the midst of all of these extremes now that are taking place around us, there is a new extreme style of basketball. It's called slam ball. How many of you have ever heard of slam ball? A couple of these Boy Scouts down here have heard of slam ball. The rest of you hadn't heard about it. Well, it's a game that's played on a custom-made floor. It has spring-loaded trampolines placed on the floor. It's 94 feet long, 55 feet wide, baskets 10 feet high, and four trampolines in the court. They're in front of the baskets. And players wear soft helmets and body pads. Football and hockey-style body contacting is allowed. And they concentrate their efforts on bouncing, leaping, hitting, dunking. And it sounds kind of like a wild and crazy idea. And when you put a bunch of sports-crazed people together on the floor, it works. Someone said it's an adrenaline rush. It's more like feeling like Superman. In slam ball, the ball is played for 8 minute halves with a 15 second shot clock. In your face dunks are worth 3 points. Long range shots beyond the trampoline are also 3 points, and every other shot is 2. Has some pretty strict rules in it. I saw it on TV a few times and wondered what in the world I was looking at as these people sail through the air and slam into basketball. In the reading that we've had this morning from the gospel, it's Passover time. And the rules during Passover are pretty strict. Preparation for the Paschal lambs are slaughtered between 3 and 5 p.m. in the temple. The Passover meal begins at sundown with participants recounting the story of the Exodus and singing songs of praise. And then the next day, an offering of first fruits is made. Passover is commemorating God's liberation of the Israelites from Egyptian bondage, the most awesome event in their history. The faithful Jews, both then and now, celebrate what could be called an adrenaline rush as they go to the temple during Passover to worship. I was amazed in my research during this passage to understand that 2.5 million people would come to Jerusalem during the Passover time. You can imagine the excitement of these people as they made this pilgrimage to worship the celebration, to worship God, the one who delivered them from bondage. Jesus walks into this temple area, the area of the Gentiles, the outside court area. He's prepared to worship when all of a sudden there's this whole conglomeration of animals that could be purchased for a slightly inflated price, since they had already been approved by the priest, or a sheep. Several years ago, my wife and her sister and mother went up to around Charlotte during the Christmas season to shop. It had become a tradition of theirs, and they stopped at this real nice motel, and they got a price from the proprietor there, and I think the price was like $60 a night. And they went upstairs to the room, and there was a mint on each one of the pillows in the room, and a little basket of goodies there. And a sign inside the room says $235 a night. Well, my mother-in-law liked to have a cat. She began to say, "Girls, don't lay on that bed. Don't pull down those sheets." Says, "This room is not $60 a night, it's $235. So immediately they picked up the phone, and the man began to laugh on the other end. He said, "Oh, no, ma'am." Said, "It's not $235. Said, "That's only during the race week." So it was something like that, I'm assuming, that these Jews were experiencing when they came to the temple. If you were journeying from a long distance, you wouldn't bring your animals with you because it could be such a task to get them over the mountains or through the desert or wherever. So you would come and purchase your animals there at the temple. But some people who did bring their animals, I understand that most of the time they would be told, "These are not quite good enough. But we'll give you a price for your defective animal, and we'll sell you our acceptable animal for sacrifice." And so they would make the transition only to find out that the defective animal was taken around to the back of the temple, and the next day, guess what? All of a sudden, wonder of wonders, it was acceptable. At a more inflated price, of course. And also, if you were to come to the temple and you were from one of those Gentile regions where they happened to have the image of the emperor stamped in the coin, well, guess what? You don't have graven images in the temple. Those coins were not acceptable to pay the half shekel temple tax that every good Jew would pay. So you would have to exchange your money at, of course, the accepted rate, since your money was defective. And in the midst of all of this money changing hands and all of this transition that was taking place, there was also all of these animals in the temple area with all of the smell and the manure and all this other stuff scattered around. And Jesus had gone there to worship. And along the way, he began to pick up a few of these leather straps that had been used to secure the animals. He began to put them in his hand. And somewhere along the way, Jesus had had enough. He kicks over the money changers' tables. He runs the animals out of the temple. He said, "You have made my Father's house a place of den, a den of robbers." The temple, that sacred place for all Jews. If you've ever been to Sunday school for any length of time, you know about the development of the temple from the children of Israel when it was first a tent area and they carried the Ark of the Covenant that was placed inside the Holy of Holies. But there was no permanent place for years, and David wanted to build it, but he was too warlike, so Solomon, his son, built it. And then that temple was destroyed, and another temple was built, and then that one was put into ruins, and then there was this temple. The temple that it took 46 years, the great builder, Herod, to build, and it was a beautiful manifestation of God and God's presence. Jesus said, in so many words, "This stinks. This is not what true worship is." I think about those images that speak to us. I know when I was overseas, and for many of you, I know the same thing. In a foreign conflict, and you see the American flag waving somewhere, it just stirs you. I have literally seen grown men have tears rolling down their face when they saw the flag and heard the national anthem being played, and it stirred their souls. I can remember looking at one of my friends one day and saying, "What's wrong?" He said, "Oh, I'm just having a patriotic moment." I think about the Statue of Liberty and what it means to us as Americans, and how we don't want to see it damaged and blown up by some group of terrorists, but we know that if a terrorist had their way, they would blow it up today if they had the chance. It's that image that speaks about who we are, what we stand for. That was the temple. That was a temple for the Jewish people. And when you walked inside to worship, it brought reverence. And here was this day, this wonderful day, Passover, when he was telling the story of liberation. And you walk in and it's anything but reverence. I think about those cheaters that were there that day. Those people that were just there to make a living. You know, in my pastorate, I have met businessmen that have gone to talk to them maybe after visiting the church, and I would say to them, "You know, we would love to have you to become a part of our church." They said, "Yeah, you know, a church is a wonderful place to make business contacts." Jesus had had enough. He takes a slam dunk sort of attitude. The disciples were shaken by all this transaction, and they remembered what was written about the Messiah when it says, "Zeal for your house will consume me." And Jesus was not only saying something about the temple, but he was also saying something about himself. He was saying something about who he was when he said, "Destroy this temple, and in 3 days, I'll raise it up." those that had no understanding of the spiritual reality of what Jesus was saying thought he was talking about that temple that had taken them 46 years to build. The disciples were confused. They only understood in reflection to the death, burial, and resurrection of Christ. But here we are today. Here we are today in this beautiful sanctuary that has been a part of this community for over 150 years. Here we are today gathered in this place that speaks about God and worship. It speaks about who we are and what we have been in the past. And we gather here with the reassurance, as I mentioned in my prayer, that where two or three are gathered together in my name, Christ said, I am in the midst. My question is, sometimes do we gather in Christ's name? What is our attitude of meaningful worship? I've asked this question before and I can ask it again, I think, this morning. Have you ever come to church and not worshiped? And I ask you, whose fault is that? We can build effective and meaningful styles of worship, and we can include the Lord's Prayer and the affirmation and the call to worship and the reading of the epistles and the reading of the Gospels, and we can have the prayers and the choir can sing. Does it mean that you have worshiped? Or have you let the things of this world so steal your attention that you, in essence, have come into God's house and you have left and you have never experienced God's presence in your life? Surely, if that happens, it's the preacher's fault. Surely it's the choir's fault. Surely it's someone else's fault. When we worship God in spirit and in truth, we know His real presence in us and among us, and we realize that Christ indeed is risen. Who is our real temple? Who is our real altar? Sometimes when we come to church, we let those things bother us. I put a little note in here. What if we came into the church and people were talking on their cell phones during worship? What if someone was playing on their laptop computer, or someone else was playing a video game? We do need to be undistracted in our worship. There may always be some types of natural distractions. I've always said that babies crying in worship is a sign of a growing church. Would we had more children wiggling in our pews. People certainly need to go back and forth and use the restroom. There are those things that affect our attention. But I think about That passage that says, I was glad when they said unto me, let us go into the house of the Lord. Wouldn't that be great if all our little children were so excited about worship and about what was taking place here? They said, I just can't wait to get to church. I was talking with some parents here the other day about this very church, and someone was saying something about going to another congregation, and the little kid said, but that's my church. And it changed the whole discussion with that family around the table when that child said, that's my church. That's my place of worship. Jesus, the anger that drove him caused him to show that he was truly the Messiah sent from God. His zeal was eating him up. He had passion. We are in the season of Lent, a time to deny ourselves, to search our lives, and to ask. When we come into the house of worship, are we defiling God's house by our attitudes? The attitudes that we bring into this place of worship? You see, God don't want no dirty house. Amen.